This episode contains offensive and potentially harmful language that refers to Black communities in Canada. Some of the stories that are shared also include vivid descriptions of physical and verbal violence that may be difficult for some listeners to hear. Discover Library and Archives Canada presents Porter Talk. This production explores the lived experiences of Black men who labored as sleeping car porters for both the Canadian National and Canadian Pacific Railways during the 20th century. Their voices, along with those of their wives and children, relay stories of both hardship and resilience. This is the first season of Voices Revealed, a series that amplifies the voices of underrepresented and marginalized communities held within Library and Archives Canada's vast oral history holdings. Narratives of injustice, conflict, persistence, and resolution enable us to understand how the past powerfully defines our present. They also provide compelling insights that push us to imagine new directions for a collective future. My name is Richard Provencher, and as your host of the first season of Voices Revealed, I am pleased to guide you through the stories that are at the heart of Porter Talk.
Did the railways treat the porters' communities across the country fairly in a historical sense?
Not really. The railroads were ruthless employers. We had no rights that they were bound to respect. We were treated like things rather than human beings. I'd come in from Vancouver after four nights on the road back to Toronto, and I would be shipped out the next night. And if I didn't agree to go, there would be action taken against you. Not overt penalties, but we won't forget that you turned us down this time. And we worked sometimes for over 400 hours a month for $70, $75 a month. Over 400 hours of work. No pay for overtime.
You're doing a book on the Black porters across the country. What's the kind of bottom line of that book? Why are they so important to Canadian history?
I think one of the best lessons that can be learned from the presence of sleeping car porters, all Black men, is that they can do it themselves. We organized the union without a government grant. On our paltry income, we were able to do for ourselves, organize a union. So the lesson that the porters can give to the community, and it's important that the history of porters be documented, is that you have the ability, if you wish, to throw off the shackles of slavery and free yourself.
When Stanley G. Grizzell was interviewed by CBC journalist Bill Cunningham in 1991, he repeatedly emphasized the inherent inhumanity of portering. A predominantly Black profession dating to the 1870s, porters did not experience improvements to their exploitative working conditions until the mid-1900s. They continued to face employment practices reminiscent of slavery. Evelyn Marshall Braxton, who was related to a long and extensive line of sleeping car porters, shares a story about the indignity her father-in-law faced on the rails.
I remember my father-in-law told me that when there was no union, when he was a railroad porter,
who was that?
Christopher Marshall, but he was born in Barbados, and he said one lady came on the train and she was calling him Sam and Sam and Sam. And he says, "My name is not Sam, my name is Christopher," which he was proud of that name. And however, the conductor wrote him up and said he was rude to this passenger. Of course, there was no union. And he went up and the CPR called me. He said, "I told him my name was Christopher. I am not Sam, never has been Sam." So he said, "Well, you have to write and apologize to her." He said, "I will not. I came from Barbados and I have my trade and here's your keys." He was his own union. He was his own brotherhood man. And he went on from there and went to his trade and he continued on and he made a good life for himself.
Mrs. Braxton's father-in-law was unique in his ability to take back power from the passenger and the company official, who rendered him invisible. His expertise and self-assuredness went on to define the life he created for himself beyond the rails. Most men, however, could not make a similar career move. Educated or not, black men had few opportunities that accorded them a stable wage outside of portering. These men formed bonds, and it was these tightly woven social worlds that enabled them to subtly navigate the disrespect and discrimination they routinely faced on the job. They dreamed up imaginary stories about their passengers, which allowed them to predict their personalities and devise creative ways to collectively respond to their demands. Flagging potential problems ahead of time and working together as a team to address them when they occurred were subtle but important forms of dissent. This camaraderie was cross-border, as porters forged connections while regularly making their way across Canada and the United States. Their shared experiences, both on the job and in society at large, connected them to the larger battles they waged against anti-black racism in both countries. As privileged members of their communities, they knew that raising their voices was the only way to fight for a better world. Quiet resistance allowed porters to manage passengers, but white supremacism defined the exploitative corporate culture they faced when butting heads with company officials, and it was of little help for them to appeal to the Canadian trade union movement, given its similar foundations. As a result, the drive to unionize was complicated, a long-haul battle for the ages. Porters rolled up their sleeves and chipped away at the cause, bit by bit, over many decades. Those who worked for the Canadian National Railway fought to change working conditions through their membership in the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees, while those employed by the Canadian Pacific Railway sought the ability to form a union free of company control. Dr. Stephen High, professor of history at Concordia University, and the author of Deindustrializing Montreal, Entangled Histories of Race, Residence, and Class, gives us an overview of the Canadian labor movement, the color barriers implicit within it, and the early challenges that CNR porters faced when organizing.
Now, the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees is one of the first Canadian unions. And so, and it was, you know, a major player on the CNR, or the Grand Trunk, and then later the Canadian National Railway, which was government-owned after World War I. The porters are black, and they're not allowed to join these unions. And so they organized, right? So the Order of Sleeping Car Porters emerged in 1917, and it's the first sort of large-scale black union in North America. It precedes, you know, the organization of black porters in the United States by about a decade. And so they organized both on the Canadian National Railway, and they were trying to organize the Canadian Pacific Railway, but that corporation was very, very anti-union, and they basically fired, you know, all the black organizers, who then, you know, most of them took on jobs in the CNR. And so you had this, you know, this black union, right? And they wanted to join the Labor Federation, the Trades and Labor Congress of Canada, which is the House of Labor. And the Federation sort of said, well, you know, you have to join an existing union. You have to join this Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees. But that union had a white-only clause. And so it took a year, right, when that union, you know, manages to vote out that clause, to change that clause, in order to incorporate this black union into this, you know, into this white union. And so it becomes like a multiracial experiment. They're facing all kinds of discrimination within the union. They have separate seniority lists, right? So if you are a porter, you can't, you know, there's no social mobility. You can't get promoted into become like a conductor, right? Because those are separate seniority lists, or perhaps a separate union. And so really, you know, once you're hired into a position, you're pretty much locked in, right?
The Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees eliminated the white-only clause from its constitution in 1919 becoming one of the first unions in Canada to remove racial restrictions from its membership policy. Black railway workers became full members, organizing into all-black local unions that lobbied hard, albeit with little early success, against the CNR's segregated job classification and seniority systems. Meanwhile, the CPR stuck to its anti-union stance. The slow pace of change was a hard pill to swallow for some porters, and especially those who had supported fellow white workers during the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919. Listen as Dr. Mathieu, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota and author of North of the Color Line, Migration and Black Resistance in Canada, 1870 to 1955, shares this little-known history with us.
Sleeping car porters in Winnipeg were at the biggest, most important, most transformative, most alarming strike that we get in 1919, right? The thing that makes it clear to government and Canadians writ large that unions are not going anywhere. And what Canada needed to do in part to have post-World War I peace is to recognize that, embrace that, and fold it into the way that we think about work, right? Super transformative. And it's also part of a global work protest culture that we get after World War I. The way that I found out that porters were at the strike is a note, like a little slip in the porter records where they acknowledged the donations that they had made to the very union that would not have them. The very union that for years had said, you're not man enough. We don't respect the work that you do enough. You would bring us down if we included you. You can't be a part of this machinery that defines modernity and manhood and work. And rather than do what many might have done, which is to cross their arms and go, well, how does that bottle feel on the side of your head, striker? They instead rolled up their sleeves, risked their jobs, because it isn't as though they could get a different job if they got fired, right? And showed up. The strikers are walking right past where porters are living by the train tracks. They're walking right past their stores, their apartment buildings. They're watching that energy that could so easily turn against them as foreign labor taking their jobs, right? And instead, they bravely say, I'm joining that group. I'm joining that march. So they're, this group that is invisible is also highly visible when it's time to take a risk. It's yet another sacrifice that in some ways might be more dangerous than the war effort. Because we don't know how that's going to end. That strike was alarming to Canadians. Violence is what everyone expected, right? And then they're immigrants. They could be deported. So it's a risk on multiple levels. And then the third thing that's really important to me about that moment and the contributions that the porters sit together around a table and decide this is what they will value, right? What's so important about that is that those are monies that they are taking out of their children's mouths. Those are monies that they could have put to any number of other uses. That was the cost of a lunch at a diner. That was the cost of a beer. That was the cost of a movie ticket. That was the cost of a date with their spouse. That was the cost of a more comfortable pair of shoes to do their work. And so if we're looking for how unions mattered to these men, who are not coming from union traditions as immigrants from Kansas, they're not, as immigrants from or migrants from Canadian farms, right? There you have it. There you have it on the streets of Winnipeg during the most dangerous time to be on those streets. There you have it in putting their name to paper on those contributions to union to strikers' funds. And then you still have that same set of men after calm returns to Winnipeg say, yeah, where were we? Yeah, no black people. You haven't proven that you understand and value unionism. Well, let's just wait. Let's just wait. We're moving too fast.
Although the CPR refused to support a union, it did formally recognize the Porters Mutual Benefit Association in 1921. Unfortunately, this was a company-controlled body that did little to improve working conditions. After the association's creation, the CPR established enrollment procedures,
donated office space, collected dues for sickness and funeral benefits, and welcomed association representatives to attend Management Grievance Committee meetings. But as Harold James Fowler, who ran out of the CPR's Toronto division, and Roy Williams, who was situated in Calgary, tell us, this paternalistic approach to sidestepping trade union affiliation was all smoke and mirrors.
All right, when you started as a porter, do you recall a porter's welfare committee?
Well, if you got in a little trouble, you go up there and the boss has got his job, whoever's goes up for you, so it's a begging committee because it had no power.
I see. So they looked after the...
They attempted to.
The grievances of the porters?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a company outfit, and they dominated. The porters had very little to say.
Right.
And it wasn't... whatever they said, it wasn't considered very important as far as the company is concerned. In other words, the company ruled with a hiring hand. And it was most... when grievance arose, why it was done by the local superintendent platform inspector, and they had the final decision. And many times the rulings that they handed down was very unfair to the porters involved, and it was many a man was dealt unjustly through this company.
Dr. Dorothy Williams, author of the formative texts Blacks in Montreal, 1628 to 1986, and The Road to Now, A History of Blacks in Montreal, explains how this company strategy both rendered the men powerless and divided them.
That was called gentle union busting, and it wound up pitting one black man against another. There were black men who felt, you know what, we're getting screwed by CPR. So if CPR wants to put money into our community, we're going to let them. Then there are others that, hell no, we don't want to have anything to do with them because that muddies the waters when we're trying to negotiate with them later on. And they will own us if we continue to accept their largesse. So you had these two competing views. It was not a unified black force, right? Which made it easier for the company to operate exactly at the letter of the law. Well, you're not an official union. We really don't have to sit down at the table and negotiate with you.
Despite the problems inherent in it, the Porters Mutual Benefit Association became an important organization for the men. It provided meeting rooms, recreational facilities, and in some locations, spaces to accommodate those who were on layovers. But the exploitative work conditions, which included low wages and extreme sleep deprivation, along with the company's near complete control over punishments, grievances, and firings, continued. We return to the conversation Mr. Williams had with Stanley Grizel to understand the deep consequences that resulted from belittling porters.
We were never safe. We never thought, we didn't know. In other words, I didn't know when I was going to get fired. You know, I could be fired from a wimp of a platform inspector or some employee, maybe that wasn't connected with Daniel, but then my word wasn't very much. In other words, I was on a low key. I was kind of a boyish. You know, I didn't have the privilege to speak up when knowing that I was right. And I took a lot of abuse, and I was tired of taking abuse. In other words, I couldn't talk back to defend myself when I know I was in the right. I was more or less like a boy. And I felt that with the union, I had protection and I could have a hearing and have a proper hearing as other employees, which we did not have with this company committee. And I felt we needed a change to better our conditions.
Over time, porters realized that the CPR would never relent in its anti-union stance. The company-controlled Porters Mutual Benefit Association would have to disband if change were to occur. Porters, led by Winnipeg and Montreal-based labor activists John Arthur Robinson and Charles E. Russell, began to look south of the border for help. Dr. Melinda Chateauvert, author of the classic text Marching Together, Women of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, takes us through the successful union movement that had simultaneously rolled out in the United States in the first half of the 20th century.
The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was originally dreamed up, if you will, by people in Chicago who worked as sleeping car porters and who wanted to organize. There had been various efforts on the part of the Pullman Association to keep a lid on any kind of organized resistance to Pullman labor policies. And of course, that began here in the United States with the Great Railway Strike of 1892, led by Eugene Debs. One of the outcomes of the Great Railway Strike and one of the outcomes of Debs's organizing among the railroads is the radicalization of the railway brotherhoods, which had been around for quite a while. So to organize the sleeping car porters, men took that idea of, we want to have a black brotherhood that represents the sleeping car porters, and we want that to be on the same level as the railway conductors and other brotherhoods within the railway unions. Of course, those railway unions were all racially segregated and had specific lines within their constitutions prohibiting the membership of black workers. So again, there was another reason to organize sleeping car porters in order to represent black workers almost generally in the railway trades. In organizing then, they were looking around for somebody who they could hire to be the president and lead organizer of the Brotherhood, of what would become the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And they chose not to find somebody in Chicago, in part because Pullman's surveillance strategies and apparatus was so great that they knew that anybody that they tried to find there would face all sorts of repercussions. So instead they went to New York and they found A. Philip Randolph. Randolph had had some experience organizing, not successfully, but trying to organize other black workers. And he was well known as the publisher of a radical magazine known as The Messenger, which regularly spoke to black socialists and so on socialist issues, but for a black audience. So that is who they ended up engaging to become president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters to lead the organizing campaign.
Together, Robinson and Russell reached out to Randolph in 1937, a man who, through the refinement of his leadership skills and organizational tactics, went on to play an instrumental role in the American civil rights movement. Despite the initial failures he had organizing black workers, he spent much of the interwar period working with Pullman Company sleeping car porters to establish the first black-led labor organization to receive a charter in the American Federation of Labor, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. In fact, he had just successfully negotiated its first contract that year. Robinson, Russell, and their pro-union supporters viewed this new transnational alliance with the American Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters as one of the only ways to push back against both the CPR as well as the Trades and Labor Congress of Canada, a body that continued to advocate for a white-only union model. However, taking this bold next step, as Montreal-based George Foray tells us, was not without risk. Being aligned with this American union movement could result in job loss and even blacklisting. And once blacklisted from portering, these men would be left with few options for supporting themselves and those who depended on them. As a result, not every porter viewed the drive to organize favorably.
Tell us about the how the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters came on the scene.
Oh, well, now, when the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters came in, everything was so hush-hush. Actually, nobody knew what was being transpired, excepting, like, the men who was on this welfare committee, because they were the ones that were approached, naturally, by the BSCP. The BSCP sent their scouts here beforehand, and they were the ones who canvassed the different members, and the welfare group at the time was more or less the voice, we'd say, of the porters. And although half the porters, I imagine, weren't even aware of this thing going on. But the ones who were involved, everything was very hush-hush because of the fear of what we'd say reverberations on the part of the company. And at that time, unions was not recognized in Canada, per se. And it was more or less during after the, well, when the war got going in full swing, then the different laws were enacted by the government and made it where it was, it had to be accepted by the various large organizations that employed over and above a certain number of employees. So they couldn't actually turn them down. But there was a lot of reverberations, besides a lot of backlash, we could say, from that. And so the men had to be careful because they had nobody to protect them. The welfare group was there, but they couldn't actually help a brother if he was in dire problems with the company. They could only intercede in minor cases, you know, just to say, like, you have a representative, somebody speaking for you, yeah, to back you up. Because the men in those days, you must remember, they were very timid. They were very timid and bulldozed by the company. And old men were treated like little boys by whoever that was white and represented the company. I mean, they could bulldoze a porter because you were just part of the equipment. That's what they used to call us, part of the equipment. As long as the cars rolled, we rolled. No rights.
As soon as Robinson and Russell established sound relationships with Randolph and other leading officials within the American-based Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, moves to organize CPR porters into the newly named International Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters began in quick succession. Mr. Williams gives us a sense of the events that transpired and his role in the process in Calgary.
Tell me about the organizing of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Were you involved in the organizing of it?
Yes, I was. I took part in the organizing of the porters. When we got the word that from the delegation from Montreal that Brother Randolph was coming to organize in Canada, well, and they advised us to set up a committees and start collecting dues for this for his appearance in Montreal with the committee there. And we I was elected to collect dues in Calgary, one of the first to be collecting dues in Calgary for the men, which is $2 a man.
Organizing CPR porters continued during the Second World War, made easier by the travel these men did and the information they shared across black communities within both Canada and the United States. In 1942, Robinson passed on the leadership mantle to his nephew, Arthur R. Blanchette, and within a year, he and Randolph had negotiated one of the most lucrative union contracts in history. The adoption of the Wartime Labor Relations Regulations in 1944 surely helped their efforts. This was national legislation that protected workers' right to unionize in places that fell under federal jurisdiction. The first contract between the International Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the CPR was signed in February 1945. Despite this major win, a difficult transition period lay ahead. Joseph M. Seeley, who served as the president and vice president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Montreal Division, explains.
It took a long time for the platform inspectors, whether it was Montreal, Toronto, Winnipeg, Calgary, or Vancouver, to really understand and appreciate what a union meant. So therefore, they broke the rules so many times, and so many times they have been slapped with these infractions.
Which resulted in claims then?
Claims, right. And they had to pay them.
Challenges aside, gains made in the historic first collective agreement negotiated between the International Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the CPR in 1945 dramatically improved working conditions for black men. Odell Holmes, who served as the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Calgary and Vancouver divisions, and Mr. Seeley, describe some of the highlights that came about after its implementation, speaking in depth to the power they were able to take back as a result.
Our working conditions were, we eventually got down to a 208-hour month from I forget now what it did figure out to when you work 30 days a month, 24 hours a day, it was 700 some hours or something like that, but you know, we got it down to 208 hours, which was pretty well standard with most of the working classes across Canada. It didn't coincide with the Pullman Company at that time. I think they were working 205. But we did get down to 208, so that was a real reduction in hours. And we gained more respect from management. Our pay was increased considerably, and we had enough. It improved our ability to go before management and argue our points and discuss our time, and we didn't have to take the platform man's word, or whoever we approached, take his word for it and say that was it and that's all you're going to get. We could go in and show him by the rule book that we were entitled to this or whatever, and he had to abide by it, because the management learned what it was to work under a signed contract.
Right.
So in every respect, it was a dramatic change, all for the better.
How about individual treatment by individual company representatives towards the porters? Was there a more...
Oh, well, that's something that is beautiful for me to explain to you. That was something, because when I first started, I never knew what my name was, but as soon as the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters came in, instead of being called Porter, John, Henry, or anything else, I was called J.M. Seeley, to the end. I knew who I was. I received more respect from the inspectors and management. As a matter of fact, I don't want to travel too fast. Anyway, it was much better. Everything was much better. It was a pleasure to go to work.
Meanwhile, CNR porters, who were members of the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees Union, plotted about how best to break the company's segregated job classification and seniority systems. In 1927, the company and the union agreed to divide employees into two groups. Group 1 included all dining car employees and sleeping car conductors, while Group 2 consisted of porters. These separate collective agreements stated that seniority and promotion of these employees would be limited to the groups into which they were hired. Black workers were thereby locked into portering, barred from transferring to other jobs or being promoted within the CNR's ranks. With little progress made in the intervening years, Randolph called on CNR porters to join with the International Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters after its first collective agreement was signed with the CPR in 1945. Mass rallies across the country, which drew thousands, forced some change. In particular, the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway Employees appointed a special black representative, E.L. Swift, to take porters' grievances to management. As a result, black trade unionists stuck with their interracial union. This development went on to serve as an important first step in helping other black men rise to senior positions in this national union. Changing the CNR's segregated job classification and seniority systems would take decades. In fact, it was not until 1964, with the creation of the Canadian Brotherhood of Railway, Transport, and General Workers, that all waiters, supervisors, and other non-skilled groups came together under one collective agreement, free of color barriers. This development also eventually led to the establishment of a highly controversial combined seniority list that made it possible for CNR sleeping car porters to climb industry ranks. There are very few testimonials in Stanley Grizzell's interview collection about the impact these union wins had on CNR porters. It is, however, safe to say that the sentiments shared by those who worked for the CPR and whose experiences dominate his collection can be applied across the board. Let's listen to some of the concluding remarks Charles Allen Milton Hogg and Clarence Est made when Grizzell asked them to summarize the impact the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters had on their lives, their families, and their communities.
Well, I can say that the input of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters on the black community as a whole cannot be underestimated, because in those days, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in most parts of the country was a Negro. Negro's voice. That's the only voice that they had. They gained a certain amount of self-respect for themselves and dignity. Even on today's youth, you can go back and trace it back that the elementary and most elementary thing that today's youth can't carry is that self-respect and dignity. And that was the theme, in my opinion, and the foundation on which the Brotherhood was built and preached its gospel. And that sank into the black man, and up to this day, it still exists.
Do you think that the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters contribute anything to the total community, either the total community or the black community in particular, other than raising wages and improving work?
No, yes, it did. It developed, it established in the minds of the porters a certain amount of pride, and that was exemplified in a way that porters, knowing that the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters were behind them, could fight for justice. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters gave them courage and gave them that right to not to be downtrodden, to stand up for justice, for truth, and for that what would benefit the interest most.
Right. Do you think that the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters
help to spawn any other organizations or to give any other organizations in the community added strength?
Yes, it certainly does, because at one time, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was the main organization in Montreal. Anyone wanted counsel and wanted support and sustenance could find it through the means provided by the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
The union gains we just heard about would not have been possible without the strong and devoted women who stood with porters. Coming up in the fifth episode of Porter Talk, we'll meet some of those who stepped up in their homes and stepped out in their communities. Without their commitment and persistence, little would have been possible in light of the men's absence working on the rails.
Well, I think with anything, the women should support the men in their lives. And I guess you've heard that old phrase, behind every good man, there's a great woman.
And you had to have the women behind you before you had a strong union, because if you didn't have them working with you, you were nowhere.
If you're interested in hearing more from Helen Williams Bailey, Frank Collins, and others who welcomed Stanley Grizel into their homes in the late 1980s, subscribe to Discover Library and Archives Canada. You'll receive episodes as they are released, which introduce you to these men as well as their wives and children. Together, they give voice to Black life on and off the rails during the 20th century. Leading Black scholars and historians help us contextualize Porter's experiences, enabling us to understand the myriad ways these citizens faced obstacles and persisted nevertheless. Thank you for being with us. I'm Richard Provencher, your host. You've been listening to Porter Talk, the first season of Voices Revealed. Special thanks to our guests, Dr. Melinda Chateauvert, Dr. Stephen High, Dr. Sage Mathieu, and Dr. Dorothy Williams. You can find biographies of each person who participated in this episode in the show notes. There, you will also find an episode transcript with embedded timestamps that link you to the original interview content in the Grizel Collection. Feel free to explore and share these stories widely. We also acknowledge those who translated this episode, as well as those who did French voiceovers for it. Rolson Dieudonné, Gérard Hubert-Étienne, Bidi Coco-Alfred, Lance Joseph, Euphrasie Mujawamungu, Frédéric Pierre, and Christelle Chaco-Womasom. If you're interested in listening to the French equivalent of our podcast episodes, you can find them on our website or on your favorite podcast app. Simply search for Découvrez Bibliothèque et Archives Canada. Acclaimed musician and producer Paul Novotny composed Jazz Dance, the theme song for Porter Talk. Joe Seeley, famed jazz pianist and son of a porter, is also featured on the recording. All other music in this episode is from the audio library at blue.sessions.com. This episode was produced, written, engineered, and edited by Tom Thompson, Jennifer Woodley, and Stacey Zambricki. For more information on our podcasts, go to Library and Archives Canada's homepage, type podcast in the search bar in the top right corner, and click on the first link. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, reach out to the podcast team at the email address located at the bottom of the episode page.